you are on the guarantee, you want to make sure that that removal is contingent on your release from that guarantee. I'm not saying you can always get that, but you don't want to be not in control of the project and still on the hook for that guarantee.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Trevor began his career working at several larger Denver law firms before opening his own practice, Crow Legal, in 2018. He merged his firm with Deuda Law Group in 2021 to form Deuda Crow Legal LLC. For 10 years, Trevor has represented an array of businesses, founders, and investors. He focuses on business transactions, including the purchase and sale of businesses, entity selection and formation, equity and debt financing transactions, complex joint ventures, and commercial contracts. His extensive experience representing sponsors and investors in syndicated real estate deals including negotiating and drafting securities offering documents, JV, LLC agreements, and ancillary documents used in real estate syndications. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, the pleasure's all mine. I know we talked about this before we got on air here, but you're coming on the show today on vacation. So for all those of you who are listening, you can just give Trevor a big thanks for taking the time out of vacation to chat today. You know, you've got experience in a lot of different business backgrounds, but getting into the real estate space is probably more unique than others. Can you talk to us about why and how you started getting involved in real estate law?
Yeah, so I kind of fell into it, actually. I came out of law school in 2009, which was not a good year to graduate law school because the economy was down in the dumps. And I kind of always knew I wanted to do corporate transactional and business transaction type work and at a firm. And there was no deals being done at the time. You know, everything was down. The only work was bankruptcy and forbearance agreements with loans and litigation. And so I came out and I had to do litigation at first. Quickly learned that litigation was not my area of practice for the long term. And so I was always working to get more into the corporate stuff again, which is what I did, you know, in law school when I was working as summer associates at firms and things like that. But anyway, so I was at a firm, got back into the corporate stuff. Then I moved firms to a firm that was mainly a real estate firm, but they needed a corporate guy to help do their, you know, all the entity formation stuff, as well as handle some of the general corporate stuff that came up as part of some of their real estate clients. And so that's where I really got into it. We represented a lot of the firm that I was at that time, represented a lot of developers, a lot of just value add real estate people in the Denver area, Denver Rocky Mountain region, actually. And so, you know, I was the one putting together all the operating agreements. I was doing all the subscription agreements, PPMs for syndicated real estate deals. And that was kind of became my bread and butter. And that, along with the other corporate work that I was doing, I just kind of kept along with that. So when I left that firm and started my own firm, I just had a lot of clients that came over that are still doing these syndicated deals.
Right, right. And is that the main thing that you're working on right now, is working on syndicated deals?
Yeah, typically it's less typical for us to do just a straight purchase and sale agreement for somebody, for an investor that's just buying one property and not getting investors. Usually they come to us when they are trying to raise maybe 40% of the equity, and they're going to get, or 65, you know, they're going to get a 65% loan, and then they're going to raise the rest in equity. They don't want to put all their money into it, so they got to find some investors. And so that's usually when they come to us. So it's mainly syndicated deals, but it's across a wide range of product out there, real estate product. You know, we've done a ton of hotel deals. We've done a lot of multifamily, done commercial properties, industrial, you know, so it's a wide range.
You know, we've seen a lot of things changing, I think, in the syndication space over the last few years. We've seen a lot of deal structures change. We've seen, you know, some unique class shares come on board where it used to be a 7 prep with a 70-30 split. And now we're seeing class A gets 10%, no equity split on the back end. Class B gets the, you know, the 70-30, whatever. We've seen a lot of things change over the years. Can you kind of walk us through maybe why some of those things, or some of these syndication structures, have evolved? And, you know, does that give you any indication as to where the market is, or kind of where things are headed? I guess that's maybe two different questions, but.
Yeah, you know, what I've noticed with that, a lot of times it depends on the experience of the sponsors. And so, you know, it's kind of the progression I've seen with a lot of clients is they come in and they offer a really sweet deal in the beginning on their first few deals, you know, because they're trying to attract these investors for the first time. Once they develop that track record, then they have the background to say, all right, now I'm going to get more into, there's less risk in these deals because I have the track record. And I know, you know, you can see I know what I'm doing. And so they can usually get better terms down the road. And so I've seen that, you know, the market has been has been hot for a long time now. And so I don't know if I can really explain exactly why it has changed, but I've seen that too. But sometimes it's just sponsor specific. You know, I see some sponsors who are able to get that 70-30 split at the end. Some of them can only do an 80-20 split at the end. Some of them, you know, can offer the lower pref. And then the fees are the big one too. You know, what sort of fees are you strapping in there? Are you got management fees? Are you going to throw in a management fee? You're going to throw in also an acquisition fee, a disposition fee, a guarantee fee. If you have to do the bad boy guarantees on the loan, those vary a lot too. And I don't know if I can necessarily explain it from a market standpoint. To me, it just seems more sponsor specific, what they can get, what they're able to sell, and what kind of investors they're able to bring in.
Yeah, and that's a valid point. You know, out of the gate, you have to establish track record. And if it is your first big deal, then there is more risk, at least on paper, to the investor. So they have to, you know, they have to get compensated for that risk in some form. One of those may be a sweeter deal for the investor. That's really interesting. Are there any structures or things, you know, that you are advising against right now?
One structure, this comes up a lot, where somebody has done maybe one deal and they've been successful and they say, hey, we got one deal. Now we have this pipeline of deals, or we've really hit the streets and we have this pipeline of deals. What we want to do is go raise a fund. We want to go raise a blind fund. We don't necessarily, we have this pipeline of deals coming through, and we just want people to put in, make commitments now to invest capital. And we're going to call that capital, and we're going to invest in the deals that come down the pike. Well, it often doesn't work. And so I have had a lot of conversations with sponsors that to say, hey, we can go down this road. We can draft these documents for you, but you're going to spend time and money, and there's a good chance you're not going to be able to sell this deal, just because I've seen it happen over and over. That's where you really need this track record, a long track record, before you can do that. And then you usually have to really niche down on what you're looking for. I'm only looking for multifamily in this geographic region that meets these requirements before we can invest, that sort of thing. But typically investors, when you go to the investors, they say, rather than buy blind pool, just when you get a deal, let me know and I'll tell you if I want to invest or not. You know, I'm not going to make this, you know, $1 million commitment now and just you call the capital whenever you want. And so that I think is one structure that I've had to advise many people against, to say, hey, let's wait on that. Or what I've often said is, if you're really adamant about it, let's put together a term sheet, so we're not spending the time on all the docs yet. Just put down a quick term sheet and less time from attorney's fee standpoint. You go circulate that out and see what you get as far as interest. And you talk to investors and see if they're interested in making a commitment. And oftentimes that's when they come back and say, all right, yeah, nobody wants to invest in a blind pool with me yet. And so yes, we'll still just do this on a deal by deal basis. So I guess that's one structure I've had to advise people against several times.
Yeah. And that makes a heck of a lot of sense. I mean, because you really do have to have that track record. I mean, you've got the track record, and you got to have the investors that, you know, back you in that. And I think we're seeing more funds come out even right now, but those are usually being promoted by people who've been in the business for a long time. And even then, I'm not even seeing the funds I have personally looked at, not even seeing those as capital call funds. I'm seeing those as it's an open fund, or maybe an evergreen fund, or maybe it is closed end, but it's, you know, invest today, put your $100,000 in today. It's not wait until we have a deal. It's put your $100,000 in today, because we are buying.
Right. Yeah. The way we've got around it, and I've seen it work, is either they have the pipeline and they say, here's, you know, the five acquisitions that we're looking to do. And so that people have a chance to bet it. And we don't know if they're going to close or not, but here's the five, you know, and so this is what you're investing in. So that's one way. The other way we've kind of gotten around it is sometimes we've created a board of advisors, or, you know, board of, typically call them advisors, of the investors, so that if a majority of them vote to do the deal, like they won't, there's a definition of qualified opportunity, for example, that says, here's the opportunities, the type of opportunity we're looking for. And if we have a qualified opportunity, we're going to bring it to the board of advisors, and then the advisors are going to vote for it. And only when a majority of the advisors vote for this qualified opportunity will we be able to make a capital call. So that's been another way that's given them, the investors, some comfort that we're not just going to invest in deals that you just have on a whim think are going to be good. We want to have some say in that. And so that's been helpful too.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I think you're known for is protecting the sponsor's promote. Can you talk to us about that? And what does that even mean?
Yeah, that's a big one. You know, in these LLC agreements, And it depends on the deal, right? On what type of deal. A ground up development, the investors are relying on that sponsor to be able to hire the GC, to manage the GC, to make sure this gets built, to make sure, you know, they stay within loan covenants. And so there's a lot of reliance on sponsor to get this deal done right. And that's how they earn their promote, right? That's how, you know, you return capital, you return some pref, and now you get this promote on the back end when we ultimately sell the property that's been developed. But there's a lot of work to be done to earn that promote. And so the idea is, well, if we strike this deal and today we put in our money and then later you fail and we have to bring in a new manager to come in and manage this GC or do this project, do you still get that promote? And so that usually, you know, if you have sophisticated investors, they're going to require that there's some way that they can remove you as manager and then you lose the promote. On the other hand, if it's just kind of a value add or if it's a value add type deal where they're not going to be doing development or they're just doing a little remodeling, you know, sometimes the promote is, we can argue that the promote's earned at acquisition, that we're buying this at a price that is low in the market that we know we can turn around and sell. And there's not much work for us to be done. So we're kind of earning that promote at the acquisition. But in general, yeah. So, you know, if I'm representing the sponsor, I'm working hard to negotiate with the investors council to make sure that we have, for one, the removal of the management provisions are only for the really bad acts. You know, it's fraud, gross negligence, things like that. It's not just a bad business decision. And then two, you same thing with the loss of the promote. You don't just lose the promote. They can't just remove you and lose that promote unless it's something that's really bad that's happened. And usually people are comfortable with that because they're going to say, all right, well, I'm not going to do fraud or I'm going to do my best not to do that, which, you know, is honestly more of a, is kind of a more nuanced issue than you think, because it could be, you know, fraud, for example, could be somebody, if it's a bigger real estate organization that has multiple employees, you know, somebody could be siphoning money from a bank account that's not one of the principals or something like that. And technically that's fraud, you know, so you got to navigate those as well, especially if, you know, usually we have something if it's not the key employees, if they can pay back the money or they reimburse the company, then they can get, you know, not removed and loss of promote. But yeah, those are highly negotiated provisions. And yeah, that I see that as my job when I'm representing sponsors, is to make sure that those provisions in the LLC agreement, you know, if we can't eliminate them totally, that they're very limited in the scope on when you could be removed and when you can lose the promote.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it sounds like either you have experience or you have seen it, you know, secondhand, where a sponsor was, where they lost their promote, maybe unjustifiably. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah. I mean, that exact situation that I mentioned, there was I had a client who had a bookkeeper who was siphoning money from the company. And technically they said, you know, this was a misappropriation of funds, which was one of the loss of promote and removal of manager. Luckily in that case, and, you know, we honestly didn't in that agreement, we didn't have any protections against it not being a key employee or anything like that. And so they could have lost the promote, but luckily they had a great relationship with the investors. The investors understood that it wasn't them. This was a one-time thing, not an ongoing issue with the company or the principals. It was just one bad egg, you know. So technically they made a bad hire, but may not have known it in the past. I mean, honestly, the bookkeeper had the facts in this situation were terrible because there was some underlying, you know, the bookkeeper had got divorced and there was just a bunch of things that had gone on in that person's life that changed what that person was when they hired her versus what she was later. And so that one worked out and it wasn't a removal, but it did key me into, hey, this can happen. And, you know, there is insurance that can protect that, which is helpful, but also, you know, the provisions in the operating agreement to say, if you can reimburse that amount, you know, because the investors are going to say, hey, we don't care, you know, maybe if it's not a key employee, that's fine, but you still got to get that money back. You know, you got to put that money back in the deal. That's not our loss. And so as long as they, in this deal, they got the money back and they were able to put it back into the company and everybody was fine. And so we moved forward. But yeah, that's certainly something I've seen in the past.
Yeah, that's wild. That's wild. And yeah, of course, I mean, it's not the investor's fault. And why, and you were the sponsor, the one that hired them. So yeah. you got to take responsibility somewhere, even if it's not, you know, your own fraud, you still have to say, all right, we got to make the investors whole, which is what I think everybody wants.
Right.
You know, unless you're just a terrible, terrible manager overall, then nobody wants to get rid of you. I guess that brings up we're getting nuanced here, but this is a question. What happens if you are removed as the manager? Who steps in?
That's a good question. Usually the operating agreement will say that the majority of the members at that point, which is the investors who have the control at that, step in to appoint a new manager. That's what I've typically seen. And so they would be able to come in and replace the manager and offer them a promote. Depends on what stage the deal is. They may even be able to negotiate a better deal now that if the project's, you know, part way along or whatever. But if the deal's in the dumps, then, you know, it's going to be hard to hire that person. It may just be on a fee-based thing where they come in, we'll come and manage the process and manage the property and try to bring it to sale. But we don't need a promote. We just want a management fee. And they're going to just take a fee moving forward on that. Could be the example. But usually it's the members at that point, the remaining investor members.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, hopefully we never have to cross that bridge. I'm sure there's been a few unfortunate cases where that has had to happen. But I think the ultimate goal is always to avoid that. By putting in the right process and the right people, to make sure that just simply doesn't happen. One last thing. Go ahead. No, please. If you've got something to add.
Well, I was going to say that actually, that happened to, we represent sponsors and investors. And one of our clients is an investor where they had to remove a manager and they ended up replacing it, that exact situation. They were the majority owners. And so they replaced him with somebody who just has taken a fee to manage the property. And so that deal's still out there going. It hasn't been sold yet. So we'll see what happens. But I've seen that.
Wow. Yeah, that's unfortunate. Well, let's all learn from everything we've just heard and not repeat those mistakes. What are some things, one last question here before we jump into the final four. What are some things that we as sponsors can do when we're working with our attorneys, such as yourself, to really make this a streamlined and easy process for both parties?
I think some of that just comes with time and doing deals. But if the sponsors that I've seen that have been really successful usually have created some sort of program, investment program, and it takes time. Like you've done your first deal and you've got a group of investors, and then usually you're going back to that well of investors. And so once you've developed that base of investors and your kind of program on how the deal works, then a lot of this stuff gets really streamlined. If you're running the same deal, like you're always buying the same sort of class of real estate, you're always offering this pref, you're always offering this split, you always have these management fees in there. It just really makes those operating agreements, any disclosure documents, PPMs and subscription agreements, they become really rinse and repeat at that point. And so the investors love it. As long as you're successful in returning funds, they'll just keep on investing. And so that's what I've seen with sponsors that have been really successful and able to streamline. At the outset, it's just, I don't know if there's a way to streamline. And I mean, it's having a good idea of what you're looking for on those topics. But when you can get to a point where you have the same investor base that you're going back to each time, and they understand and know the terms that you've given before, and you're going to be just rinse and repeating with those same terms, it really makes these things go quick.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely good advice there. Very good. Anything else before we jump into the final four questions that you'd like to share with our audience?
I think that's it. I mean, you got your questions right. I took some notes here about things that I thought I would talk about, and you honestly hit every single one of them. So
great, good deal. Well, here we go. The first question is this: if I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate and you had no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
Oh my goodness. For me, since I'm the attorney here and I haven't been doing these deals, I don't think I have the wherewithal to sponsor the deal myself. So I'd probably find a good sponsor, which I know a lot of them. And I would go out to them and say, hey, I got $20,000. Let me get in on your next deal. And that would be what I would do with it.
Perfect. Love it. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Okay. This is kind of a nuanced issue, but this is for those sponsors out there. We talked a little bit about removal of manager and loss of promote. One thing to be cognizant of is if you are on the guarantee, you want to make sure that removal is contingent on your release from that guarantee. I'm not saying you can always get that, but you don't want to be not in control of the project and still on the hook for that guarantee.
Wow. That's something. Yeah, that is nuanced, but I mean, that's a golden nugget. Yeah, that's something I wouldn't have considered. That's really fascinating. Yeah. Can you say that one more time?
If you're the sponsor and you had to sign a guarantee, especially in development deals, you might be on the environmental or bad boy guarantees there, carve outs. And if so, you want to say that, the removal of the manager and the loss of promote provisions in the operating agreement, you want to say that those can't happen unless you've been released from that guarantee. Because you don't want to lose control of that project while still being on the hook for the guarantee, because at that point somebody can go off and they could sell the property for less than the amount just to get out of it and then you're on the hook for the remaining. And so that's a huge thing to think about, is that those guarantees, and you don't want those to be decoupled with your ability to manage the project.
Yeah, that's absolutely. I was thinking, I even took it one step further for people that come in who are, you know, maybe high net worth individuals that are signing on as a loan guarantee and are not actually the manager. So, right. Or the sponsor. So, you know, as if I were just a third party guarantor saying, all right, I'll put my balance sheet against this project and I'll sign off on it and back up the debt. Great. But that's contingent upon this person staying in charge.
Yeah, it could be the contingent on them staying in charge. I think that's huge. And sometimes that's in there. A lot of times too, there's a provision in the operating agreement for that guarantor. If that guarantor is represented or, you know, sophisticated in doing that sort of thing, it, that says if there's a loan default, then they take charge. They come in and they're now, if there's a loan default, they come in and they are now the manager. They decide what to do with the property. They decide when to sell it and how to negotiate with the bank and all that. And so that's another way to handle that.
Right. That's brilliant, man. I love it. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
You know, first thing that comes to my mind is just investing the time with my kids to hopefully make them good and productive members of society and in this world and just good people. So I think that's the main thing I'm doing right now.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. You know, and raising kids is probably one of the hardest things that we'll all ever undertake. So good for you. Good for you. Last question for you, Trevor. If a listener want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah. So best way is email. It's, you know, or check out our website. Email is trevor@doidacrow.com. That's DOIDACROW.com. And just Trevor. And so you can reach out that way. Or check out our website, doidacrow.com, DOIDACROW.com. And you can see what we do. We do a lot of business transactions, a lot of real estate syndicated deals. And we do it, you know, we've done these across the country. We're located in Denver, but we've done deals. We closed a deal in Florida. We closed a deal in North Carolina. We've done deals in St. Louis. So we've done them all over the U.S. So happy to talk to you, especially if you're out there syndicating a real estate deal.
Awesome. Trevor, thanks so much for your time. I do appreciate it.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.